The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. We'll resume where we left off on Wednesday with Minskew. And again, if everyone, when they don't have to do it right now, but when they start, if they would identify themselves for the record, please, and whatever distinction with Minskew would be appreciated. So, Vice Chancellor King, where are we exactly?
Mr. Chair, is that a metaphysical question or a three-ring binder question?
When you get to my next question, you'll find out.
Mr. Chair, my notes indicate that we left off on tab 12.
All right. Does this section have the stick men in it?
Mr. Chair, no, we were not able to work the stick figures into this section.
And you remember, I did pose a question about the relationship of your stick figures to a certain Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle novel, and I assume you researched that and got the correct response.
Mr. Chair, I did research it, and I learned not enough to understand the reference.
Well, it's The Adventure of the Dancing Men, and it's a murder-suicide, just so you know. But your stick figures are remarkably close to those in the story, so if there is a corollary, which I hope there is not, the budget forecast comes out tomorrow. So proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will inquire of our graphic artists if they had that in mind.
I'm almost sure they did. If they didn't, they will now.
Thank you. Starting then, if I might, where we left off, we were on tab 12 talking about the reserves and unexpended funds on our financial statements at the end of fiscal 12. And you'll see on the graphic, we have in total several sources of unexpended funds. We have funds that remain in our what we call restricted expendable balances, which are equal to 22% of the total. This relates to the revenue fund, principally, and external grants. I mentioned last time we were together, the rating on the revenue fund is AA2 and AA-. And there was a question from one of the members about how our rating compared to the rating at the University of Minnesota. And I believe that was Representative Winkler's question, and I don't see him here, but perhaps I'll just convey what I found, and you could pass it on to him. I looked at the University of Minnesota financial statements alongside the financial statements for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. A couple of differences that explain the rating difference. Principally, I think they have total assets of over $5 billion compared to total assets of just under $3 billion for us. They have annual revenues of about $2.96 billion, whereas we have annual revenues of $1.8 billion. So they're roughly 40% larger than we are. They also have about $500,000 in research funds that are not in our profile. Recall I mentioned ours is a simple operation. We have state appropriation and tuition and some earned income around parking ramps and food service and bookstores. They have a very large research function, as you no doubt know, and that contributes to about $500 million of flow on their financial statements. The other principal difference between their financial statements and those of the system is about a $1.7 billion endowment at the university that's not present at Minskew. They, as you know, have a deep history through their foundation of fundraising, and that is not our history. I think, Mr. Chair, that those are the principal explanations: very large research presence, strong endowments, and overall just a more substantial operation.
Vice Chancellor King, I did raise the question of how and when these reserves are used. You did state that there was a floor, and that floor dealt with accreditation. But certainly, looking at your chart, many of these campuses are above that floor. So can you give examples of both the 2 years, the technical college and the community college, and then at a state university, where these reserves would be used? And again, my concern is that when the state went to zero in reserves, you were actually increasing your reserves, and we were simultaneously then cutting your budget. So can you give me examples of how or if these reserves are ever used, or do you just use them as a bank?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I can certainly give you some examples, and I can also give you a better answer to the question you asked when we were last together about the accrediting agencies' minimums. What you don't have in your materials, and if you're interested, I can certainly provide it, but it felt like too much technical stuff, are the four measures that compose the composite financial index. One of those measures is called the primary reserve, and that is the cousin to the budget reserve that is the language we've used here over the years. The primary reserve has a floor in the HLC vernacular of 0.133, which isn't going to be anything that you recognize because we didn't give you this level of detail. We have amongst our 32 colleges and universities, more than 75% of our schools are below 0.133. That's considered red flag level with the Higher Learning Commission, but it adds up with the three other measures, and that's what brings us out of the red flag zone. It's absolutely the case, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chancellor King, why don't you refresh the memory of the committee, because we have many new members, as to what the Higher Learning Commission is.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The Higher Learning Commission used to be called the North Central Accreditation, I think. They are one of five nationally chartered, regionally based entities that are the accrediting agencies for all higher education in the United States. And having accreditation from our regional accrediting entity is a necessary condition for us to participate in the federal financial aid program. Our schools go through accreditation reviews at a minimum every 10 years, and under certain conditions they might be reviewed as often as twice in 2 or 3 years. We just had Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, for instance, go through a very close accreditation review because of a very large change in their financing tied to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. This is a necessary standard of excellence and academic quality, financial condition, governance that is documented and reviewed a required condition for participating in the federal financial aid program. They use this composite financial index, which is in your book, as their measuring stick for financial capacity. And were a college or university to fall below one in this measuring stick, it puts them into the red flag zone with the Higher Learning Commission and requires then a workout plan and close scrutiny by the accrediting entity to be satisfied that the financial condition of the college or university has long-term sustainability. We have one school right now that we expect to receive a letter this year from the Higher Learning Commission because they've moved into the red flag zone. And we have several schools that are working really hard this year to improve their financial positions to avoid that warning letter.
What's the one school, Vice Chancellor?
Central Lakes College.
Central Lakes, I believe, is what she had said. College.
Central Lakes College, that's correct. Central Lakes College has worked very hard for several years to get their financial circumstances stable. They've made good progress, but it is a multi-year struggle for them. So to your question, Mr. Chair, about the reserves, particular examples of reserve use, the most recent one concerns the Rochester Community and Technical College Heinz Center remodeling, which was funded through the HEPER program, funded through capital bonding. Once they got into the building, they made a big asbestos discovery, and rather than stop the project and redo the capital program, they were authorized to use their reserves to finish out the project and then modify their financial plan to restore the reserves over several years.
Members, this is a critical point. If you are visiting these campuses, this is not uncommon. And in the campuses I visited over the last 6 months, you have this happen periodically because it's impossible to discover this particular type of a problem until you get into it. And this is why I raised the question of how the reserves are used, because it is important to know that they will be used, and they should be used, to fix a building that is sick. And in this case, it's happened. If you have campuses that you represent, I would, again, highly recommend you take a tour, particularly a capital tour, and take a look at all of the different ways these buildings are built and repaired.
Mr. Chair, I would say that we try not to be surprised in our capital improvement programs. We try to know what we're going to find when we open the building up, but on occasion we are surprised. I have with me today Brian Yolitz. Brian Yolitz is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Capital Programming and Facilities, and as we move into the capital tab, I'm sure you'll hear more from him. But
Vice Chancellor, can you give us an example of a four-year university that would also have dipped into reserves?
Mr. Chair, the one that comes to mind is Bemidji State University, as they went through a fairly substantial financial redesign several years ago as they looked out and saw what was happening to their enrollment. And they used reserves for their separation program and for teach-out costs as they closed programs but finished the program out for the students that were enrolled. That's a recent example. You'll see in your materials that we have occasions where new programs are developed and reserves might be used to fund the program development. Once the enrollment kicks in and the revenues come from the enrollment, then the reserves get payback. That happened at Century. It happened at Lake Superior.
Thank you.
Certainly. Focusing again on the pie chart, the enterprise funds also had balances at the end of 12. The enterprise funds are where we account for the activities on campuses that are designed to have at least a break-even cost structure, like bookstores, like parking ramps, like computer stores, and they, as a natural course, will produce some balances that cash flow their operations from year to year. You'll also see balances in the Special Revenue Fund. These relate to student activity accounts. The student associations levy a fee. The fee creates some revenue. The students approve the spending plan. And there might be money left from year to year that we account for in the Special Revenue Account. It's also where the health services programs, child care programs, and intercollegiate athletics happen. Those are substantially student-based activities, and they're governed by a consultation process that establishes what the fee is going to be and what the program is going to be that they spend it on. And then the balance you see there is the general fund reserves, and that's the source we turn to for the examples that I gave a few minutes ago for sudden campus shocks. The last couple of years, you heard me mention that our colleges and universities have they've ended their budgets with a slight balance. But in the early part of our study period here, from 06 to 09, they were spending balances every year as they worked to fix their cost structure with the state withdrawals. So the reserves help us with that plus and minus from one year to the next. National standards would suggest that we have 3 to 6 months of reserves. The Higher Learning Commission flag that I mentioned translates, when you get work the numbers out, it translates into about a month and a half to 2 months of reserves. Our reserves at this level are about 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, depending upon the college or university. You have in your binder a table that shows you how many payroll periods could be covered by the reserves that are on hand, and that ranges from 1.5 to about 2.5, 2 3/4 payroll periods. We measure it that way in part because it reminds us that when we were facing a shutdown several years ago, we were very concerned about where the resources were going to come from to cover payroll. Because we have such extended layoff periods, unlike other parts of state government that have 2-week or 30-day notice periods, we have some notice periods that are 9 months or longer. So covering payroll is a commitment of ours, certainly. Mr. Chair, with that, unless there are questions, I've reached the end of my remarks on this subject.
All right. Questions, anyone? Representative Nardis? No. All right, then proceed.
Representative Nornes, I owe you an answer to your question last week, and it's not in today's package, but it's not forgotten.
No problem.
The last tab we have, Mr. Chair, concerns the capital budget, and it's the reason why I asked Brian Yolitz to join us. He is the manager of this program. You'll see on the overhead some data around our current program. As a beginning, I would remark that we have about 21.7 million square feet of academic space across the state. We had a question last week about where we've added space. In the last 6 years, our total academic square footage has gone up about 3%, compared, of course, to an enrollment increase of about 14%. What that tells us is that our space utilization has gotten much more efficient in the last 10 years, and we can show you that on a student per square footage basis or staff per square footage. Of the total increase that we've seen in square footage over these last 6 years, 153,000 of that increase is attributable to metro area colleges, 292,000 of it is attributable to outstate area colleges, and 269,000 is attributable to universities across the state. And universities, really, it's Winona State University and Mankato State University. Once we finish demolishing the very large dorm at Winona State, at Mankato State, pardon me, Mr. Chair, we have no plans to demolish anything at Winona.
Actually, you do, but that's all right.
At Mankato State, the university square footage change will come back down to zero overall. In the case of the colleges, the outstate additions have been in three places, in Duluth at Lake Superior College, in Fond du Lac at the Tribal and Community College in Fond du Lac, and in St. Cloud at the Technical College. The Technical College in St. Cloud has seen just tremendous enrollment growth. The Tribal College, of course, we're still building. I think right now it stands at about 100,000 square feet in total, maybe 150,000. In the case of Duluth, the legislature approved the health sciences addition there several years ago. So for all of our outstate, we've got 7 million square feet outstate. We've really focused the new square footage in three places. We have two primary ways to finance capital improvements. By far the largest contributor is the state GO program. We also sell revenue bonds with legislative approval for housing, student unions, parking programs, and occasionally we have gifts which help us build buildings. These are certainly more typical at the universities. We saw that at the Chairs University. We've seen it also at Mankato and at St. Cloud. The preponderance of our investment comes from the state GO program, with a much smaller portion coming from the revenue bond program. The legislature, back in the mid-late 90s, established an assessment to MNSCU for one-third of the debt service costs for GO programs. And we have looked at that. Now, 16 years later, campus GO debt service accounts for less than 1% of their total revenue and of their general fund revenue, and less than 1% of their total expenses. Another way to think about it is, for every dollar of tuition that's collected, 2 cents is used to pay the debt service assessment that the campus incurs.
Excuse me, Vice Chancellor. Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, how do you pay back the revenue bonds then? How does that work? Is that a student fee assessment?
Vice Chancellor.
Or some other form?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's exactly correct. The revenue bonds are paid entirely through user charges, either for a dorm room or for a student union fee or a parking fee. The projects are heavily reviewed at the campus level by the students. The students approve the project and they approve the rate structure, and then it proceeds to the board and is approved by the board. The program itself, the total indebtedness of the program, is supervised by the legislature, but the individual projects are approved by the board.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. if a building was going to go up, park ramp or something, and you're using revenue bonds then, and it gets assessed to the students via fees, are the revenue bonds over a 15, 20-year period then? So the students that come along then pick up the fees?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, President Johnson, we typically sell 10-year bonds, and you're absolutely right. There's an intergenerational dynamic going on. Often the students that are approving the projects aren't at the university when the project is finished because it takes a couple of years to get them built. So they act as stewards of the next generation of students, both in project sizing and planning. But it is the case that because they're 20-year bonds, the students that are on that campus for the next 20 years are retiring the bonds.
Representative Johnson. Representative Swizinski.
Mr. Chair, just kind of a question towards kind of the layout of the payment schedule when it comes to those student kind of end of the GO bonds. I know at the state level, we pay our bonds quickly. You know, we pay a large percentage of the initial bond within the first 5 years, and then it kind of goes away slowly as a smaller payment for a bond request.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the nature that the students over a period of time, do you have that same kind of layout with the way your structure is? You pay a large portion of the bond off initially, and then you tail it off over time, or is it kind of an equal payment over those 10 years?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swizinski, the state tries to have 40% of their principal paid off in 10 years, I think is their standard. We don't approach it quite that way because we don't have the advantage they do of a very large pool that they can balance principal interest payments across multiple issues. We typically sell what are called level principal and interest bonds so that the cost to the campus is the same every year and the mix of principal and interest inside that cost changes. That's much easier for them from a budgeting standpoint and a rate setting standpoint if the rates don't have to go up and down as the annual payment changes. So our structure is a little different.
Right. Proceed.
Returning to the cost of the GO program on our students, we've talked about it at the total revenue and expense level. We talked about it as an expression of tuition, 2 cents out of every tuition dollar. Another way to look at it is to think about, to the Representative Johnson's question, how much is the student paying per semester? And if you look at it in those terms, the cost to the students per semester for the GO program is about $22 out of their tuition, their total tuition bill. Our GO program, since the merger, has been heavily tilted on towards asset preservation and renewal. We have worked very diligently both to first establish what is our real estate footprint. We were several years finding buildings after the merger. And then once we established what is our footprint, we've spent quite a bit of time understanding the condition, how old is it, how old is the boiler, what kind of shape is the roof in. And now we've worked into a program of systematically investing in the existing buildings in order to extend their useful life and modernize them for modern teaching methods. But very limited square footage addition outside the metropolitan area.
Vice Chancellor, what's your total backlog on HEPR? Here, there was $20 million appropriated according to this box. What's your total, or Mr. Yolitz?
Let me turn to Mr. Yolitz, if I might.
Mr. Yolitz.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brian Yolitz. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. For our academic facilities, our backlog of maintenance is just shy of $700 million.
Mr. Chair, that's a number.
Vice Chancellor,
that's a number that's in the context of a replacement value that's north of $6 billion, so roughly 10%. Like in the financial domain, we in the facilities domain have something we call the facilities condition index, and this is an expression of what our backlog investment requirement is. Again, it's a national measure. It was established through national networks, and it's a reflection of how much deferred maintenance do you have in a given system. So let me, if I might ask, if it's agreeable, ask Brian to talk about that.
Mr. Yolitz.
Mr. Chair, the FCI that Vice Chancellor King was noted is basically a ratio of the backlog compared to the current replacement value. As she outlined, our backlog right now is $705 million. The actual replacement value estimated for academic facilities is $6.2 billion. It gives us an FCI of 0.11, which is on the good side of the middle of the road for national averages. And we've been trying to use local funds, R&R program at our campuses, along with the HEPR funding, along with some projects are focused on taking care of remodeling and upgrading internal facilities, and making them more efficient and effective in terms of energy operations as well as academic programs.
Mr. Yolitz, if you were giving us a priority of that $700 million, what's at the very top of the priority? What type of project?
Well, at the top of the project is going to be the integrity to keep our facilities warm, safe, and dry. We've got some projects that are required to keep us in compliance. We've got some asbestos issues, as you outlined, but the majority of the work is to keep the envelope of the facility, the roofs, and the exterior appropriate, as well as, and then the next piece is going to be the mechanical systems to keep them operating efficiently in good indoor air quality.
And what would be an estimate of that?
I'd have to get back to you on the specific percentage.
You can, but this is going to be, in conversations with Representative Hausman, we're also going to be involved in the capital project here, and Representative Hausman is very impressed with the Minsky capital project, particularly in comparison to the University of Minnesota, I might add. But the critical aspect of HEPR is going to be a high priority in this committee, just so you know.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate that. It's been the board's number one priority since 1995.
Well, I believe that was because there were certain discussions in higher ed committees as to having a building a new building rated over repairing a roof and other items. But that's okay. That I recall them fondly.
Yes. Was there a boiler involved there, Mr. Chair?
There was, and there was also a veto by a certain governor that may have had a folding chair hit too much to his forehead, but that's another issue and we won't go there. Ultimately, the governor did come around and decide that boilers were essential to a campus, but it took him a year.
We have learned a lot about our facilities, and we have invested a lot of the state's money and campus operating funds in the preservation and care of them. I think you will find as you travel around the state and visit our campuses that they're very well cared for. They look good, they're clean, they're tidy, they're bright, there's good lighting, and pride shown by the folks that maintain the buildings.
Vice Chancellor.
But our average building age exceeds 40 years, so we have pressures on them.
Vice Chancellor, there was also a requirement that anyone who would visit a campus could be given the capital list by priority, both on HEPR and new building, and I hope that still exists, so that if a member or members were to visit a campus, that one of the first things they could be shown would be that priority list, so that as presidents come and go, as legislators come and go, the list stays and those priorities remain. And I would, again, if you're visiting a campus, request to see the list. Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, absolutely, and we appreciate that, because it's been a continued effort on our part to articulate why HEPR is important when it's behind the walls and in the ceilings and not visible as a new project. Our whole capital program is driven by our master planning process, and it might be something your committee would be interested in taking a few minutes to hear about, because it's very important to our campuses, and it really sets the stage for the capital program that comes before you.
I'm going to let Representative Winkler has a question or questions. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Grunhagen is not here, but I'd like to channel his question from last time, which is, what did he say? He likes two pagers? Just at a high level, can you give us kind of budget numbers of what it costs to maintain the physical infrastructure of all Minsky campuses, both for debt service, maintenance, crews, I mean, the sort of the full capital cost of maintaining the current size of the Minsky system?
Vice Chancellor, or Mr. Yolitz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm just looking to see if we had in the supplemental materials that were requested an answer to that question, and give me a minute to page through it. Representative Winkler, you should find at your place a package with our letterhead on it that's the supplement, and if you turn to table S6 in that supplement, don't be fooled by the pagination. Read the header on each table at the top of the page. You turn to S6, which, and for fiscal 12, I'm looking at page 15.
I'm fooled by the pagination, Mr. Chair.
Turn to page S15. You'll see there the table S6 operating expense summary in thousands of dollars, fiscal 12.
Representative Winkler.
Are we together?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King. I'm with you.
These are in thousands, so if you look at the repair and maintenance column there, you'll see 32,555. That's 32 million. That shows you what's spent by campus on repair and maintenance for each of these colleges and universities. Also embedded likely in the supplies line will be some costs that are related directly to physical plant maintenance. And salaries and services will have the salaries for the general maintenance workers and the electricians. And we don't have too many trades left on the campuses, but we have a couple.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, last night's hearings, they continue to live with me today.
I've forgotten them. Go proceed.
Mr. Chair, and I presume because of depreciation, we could consider that. We could put that in there. But, you know, there's always talk, and I have one of the advantages here because I have none of your campuses in my district. There's frequently conversation about how there are just too many campuses at MinSU that we're supporting, too many different physical locations. And obviously, my sense would be the physical plant would not be the biggest share of the cost. The biggest share would be probably the people that it takes to run each location, just kind of the core sunk costs of running an institution. Do you have any comment on how we can discern or determine whether there are too many or the right number of campuses statewide?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we examine that question regularly as we're thinking about reinvestment requirements, but we come at it with a couple of considerations. One is the absolute evidence that our enrollment needs to grow if we're going to serve the workforce requirements of the next decade. That's point number one. Point number two is we have not seen, nor nationally have higher education systems seen, a drop-off in space requirements as a result of an uptick in online enrollment. You'll recall in the early days there was a real strong expectation that online enrollment would replace physical space requirements. That is not happening anywhere. It's changing the kind of physical space that's required, but it's not leading to a drop-off in requirements. So that's a consideration for us. The third consideration for us is that as we make reinvestment decisions, we're careful not to build where we don't need the space. And so our resources are focused on the life of the asset instead of replacing the asset. We do very careful planning around the capital budget and have tried over the years to demolish excess space, which was, in our judgment, excess. I will say, frankly, we've had trouble with the legislature. We've had trouble getting financing assistance to demolish assets. Maybe the winds have changed on that, but we get mixed messages about demolition as part of a larger asset maintenance program.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't really have a comment on the desire to spend money to tear buildings down, but tear them down. I don't care. I'm not going to lose any votes over it. I'm not sure if everyone around the table feels that way, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, Mr. Chair, if I might, just one final thing.
Vice Chancellor.
You'll see in the 2014 program our request for help to tear down Gage Hall at Mankato. I think that number stands at $6
million. Mr. Yolich.
Mr. Chair, the cost estimate for tearing down Gage Hall is on the order of $6 million, with a lot of asbestos abatement that needs to be done, and some caulking issues with hazardous material abatement in that area. But the campus is trying to execute that through local funds and the revenue fund, as well as reserves, as referenced in your earlier conversation. But we haven't had much success in the past in terms of capital bonding to bring a facility like that down and clean up the space on the campus. So we're executing that outside of the capital bonding arena, just to get it done so that we can free up the space for other development on campus at Mankato.
When we get to the capital section, there are dormitories that I know are slated for either major renovation or demolition, simply because they're 50 years old. And the new dorms you're building aren't really dorms, they're apartments. They're bigger than the apartment my wife and I had when we were first married, and much nicer too in a number of ways. So I again encourage members to take a look at some of these facilities. They are extraordinarily different than what we had when we went to school. Representative Reinert, are you going to comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been in the dorms at Mankato State, and as well as the new, and it's a combination of issues. I mean, I could say when I went to school, we had a cube about 3x3 square, but the point, this, what students and families want and are willing to pay for is part of what's driving that decision. And that is exactly what happened at MSU. Those dorms were built in response to, I think, kind of a surveying of the population. So it wasn't a decision on the university's part to provide the ultimate in luxury. It was to meet the demands that the families were presenting. So,
Representative Reinert, I agree, but you folks better take a look at it, because it is part of the cost of the increase too in higher ed, and it apparently isn't going away. Do you have any buildings that were built within the last 20 years that you no longer need for any reason?
That we built, Mr. Chair.
You built on a campus.
I'd have to look at the list. We have a building that we're just taking to the board next week to surplus, but it was bought from the foundation and we didn't build it. So
so there aren't any now, but I'm referring to a building on the Southeastern Technical College campus, the Aviation Center, which we had to sell, and unfortunately that building was still under 20 years old because it wasn't overbuilt. That may have been just one example, but again, when we get to the capital part of this, I'm going to be interested to note if there was any, are there any other examples of where clearly you overbuilt? And this goes to Representative Winkler's question.
Yeah.
And it may be difficult to answer, and I agree, this is a legislative issue. These are, people take a lot of pride in their structures.
Mr. Chair, we will certainly look at that. The Southeast Tech example, for me, it's not so much about overbuilding as it is about program change. That's a special purpose building that was built for a program that ended. We try hard not to do special purpose building, but we have to do it in some cases for the Big Bay technical work.
We'll
look at the list.
I recall it very well. I carried the legislation.
Yep, you did.
And it was built on city land, not on land you owned. There were complicated issues with this, and I want to make sure that we understand those complicated issues should there be any other buildings similar to it in the Minsky system. Because that was an expensive building. It was not paid off at the point of sale, if I recall, or the bonds weren't retired quite yet. If they were, it was just on the cusp of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly was a very nice building.
Mr. Chair, that was an unusual deal. It was pre-merger. The Tech College Board was involved. The Airports Commission was involved.
Right.
It was an unusual deal.
Well, if we have any other unusual deals, we'd like to hear about them.
We think we've found them all, but if we haven't, we'll let you know.
I'm always amazed at what can be discovered. So,
Mr. Chair, how else could we be of assistance here, or should I just move to closing remarks?
Before you move to closing remarks, we've had an ongoing discussion of why we're doing this, so I'm going to emphasize it for members of the committee, the audience, and Minskew. The chairs were asked to meet with the speaker yesterday. The speaker has instructed the chairs, the fiscal chairs, to build their budgets from the base. That means, just so everyone's clear, not from the governor's budget, not from new funding bills you have in committee, not from the new funding being requested by the agencies or the systems. Whatever the fiscal forecast is tomorrow, the instruction will be to build from the base, which means it is not a high priority for new programs. I just want to make sure all members understand who have bills, agencies who have requests. We are being instructed to build from the base. This is the base. Just so it's understood. Questions? And if you have questions, Speaker Thiessen, I'm sure, will answer them for you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The three-ring binder that the Chair referenced provides you with over 1,000 pages of information, and I did not count this morning's supplement, but I would venture it's another 50 pages. We have outstanding a request from Representative Grunhagen, and I owe Representative Norris an answer, and then I think we've replied to all the requests. What we find in this information is that our enrollment is up 18% over the last 10 years. State support has declined 45% in that period. Since that period started, we've educated about 66,000 more students. And produced about 16,000 more graduates. We faced a $325 million challenge in the 2008 to 2012 period, due in part to $120 million state support reduction, $94 million in inflation costs, and the need for $111 million in new investments. We addressed that challenge with $187 million in budget cuts. About 58% of the solution was through budget cuts, and the other 42% was through tuition increases. It's absolutely the case that tuition's gone up over the last 10 years, about $150 per full year equivalent college student per year, and about $260 per full year university student. But tuition has not been the preponderance of our solution. Most of our solution has come through budget cuts. From 2007 to 2012, our headcount increased by 50,000 students. Total number of employees increased by 269 students, and that's employees system-wide. At the same time, our total inflation-adjusted spending declined by 12.5%. To our earlier exchange about space, it's also the case that not only has our space use gotten more efficient, our pressure on faculty and staff to serve more students has certainly been present. Our presidents have worked tremendously hard under very difficult conditions to serve a growing number of students, improve student success, and serve their community. We're focused on access, we're focused on affordability, and we're focused on student success. You'll hear that in our biennial budget presentation, which I know is upcoming. We want to thank you for the time you have sat through with us over these last 2 weeks and your interest in this information, and we look forward to connecting our past with our future. Thank you.
Question, members? No question. On Monday, we're going to hear the report on student debt from the Office of Higher Education. Should that conclude before the end of our time, I'm going to then ask to start the budget request, which would be the University of Minnesota first, then the Minskew system. I would hope that there may be individuals who wish to testify to those budget requests and that they would then ask in advance that they testify. And anyone is, of course, welcome to testify on any of it, particularly the student debt aspect of it. The student debt will be across all systems. It'll be across the profits and for nonprofit, and it'll be a rather detailed presentation on student debt. So that will frame the budgets, and then it will, and we'll have the forecast tomorrow, which won't give us a target, but will give us a good idea of what our target will probably be. So, questions? None? Representative Dorrell, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes of February 25th be approved.
Representative Dorrell moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again soon. Meeting is adjourned.